Every day, companies you've never heard of are making millions off your personal data. Your name, address, phone number, even details about your family are pulled from public records on the internet, then sold without your consent. There's an entire marketplace built on your privacy, and most people have no idea it exists. Aura fights back. Aura removes your personal data from broker sites and keeps it off. Aura also alerts you fast if your information shows up in a breach or on the dark web. But Aura is more than just a data broker removal system. It's a full digital security suite that protects every part of your online life. Aura gives you a VPN to stay private, antivirus to block threats, a password manager for safer logins, and spam call protection to shut down scammers. Aura scans the dark web for your most sensitive information and notifies you instantly if anything is exposed. And if your identity is ever stolen, you're backed by up to $5 billion in insurance and 24/7 US-based fraud support. Other service charges about the same, but only cover one or two areas. Aura gives you everything: data broker removal, identity and credit monitoring, device protection, and fraud support, all in one simple app. Aura removes what's already exposed, protects what's not, and puts you back in control. Go to aura.com/remove for complete digital protection and peace of mind. That's aura.com/remove.
Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's changing the game. Mood.com. They created an entirely line of functional gummies, 100% federally legal THC blends, discreetly delivered right to your doorstep. And here's the best part. You can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with the promo code Ravens. Now, I've tried a bunch of their gummies myself. Each one's totally unique. The Sleepy Time gummies knock me out right away. They help me unwind fast, leave me refreshed the next morning. The Epic Euphoria gummies, they're perfect for when your day just isn't going the way you want it to go. What makes Mood special is how they pair the THC with natural herbs and adaptogens. You won't find blends like this at any local shop. They've got gummies designed for focus, relaxation, clarity, even energy, all made from cannabis grown on small, family-owned American farms. No pesticides, no shortcuts, just high-quality weed you can trust. Plus, Mood backs everything with a 100-day satisfaction guarantee. So head on over to Mood.com, check out their amazing selection, and don't forget to use the promo code Ravens at checkout to save 20% off your first order.
Get ready, Ohio. FanDuel, America's number one sports book, is coming to the Buckeye State. And to kick things off, you can get started with $100 in free bets as an early sign-up bonus. Plus, when you sign up today with promo code OhioFD, you'll be all set when FanDuel goes live in Ohio. Then you can bet on all your favorite teams in all your favorite sports with $100 in free bets. Just download FanDuel's top-rated sportsbook app. It's safe, secure, and super easy to use. Ohio, this is your chance to get in on the action. Join today with promo code OhioFD. Make every moment more with FanDuel, official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 or older and present in Ohio. Bonus issued in non-withdrawable free bets that expire 7 days after FanDuel accepts its first real money sports wager in Ohio, 1-1-23. Unique user identity verification required. Offer ends on the go live date. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
When your entire life is online, you need more than just speed from your internet. Xfinity gives you reliable in-home Wi-Fi coverage, plus protection from Wi-Fi network threats. Check out our amazing offers on Xfinity Internet. You'll get fast speed and Wi-Fi coverage you can count on. Plus, get advanced security free with the XFi Gateway, so you can keep the connected devices in your home protected from network threats. Just log in and activate through the Xfinity app. Go online, call 1-800-XFINITY, or visit a store today to learn more. Restrictions apply.
From self-help books to meditation, we work hard to find peace of mind. Xfinity Home helps you rest easy with a total home security solution installed by experts and powered by secure and reliable Xfinity Wi-Fi. You'll get 24/7 professional monitoring with fast response times and real-time alerts, like when doors and windows are opened. Rest easier with Xfinity Home. Learn more at Xfinity.com/home security. Restrictions apply. Residential customers only. Requires compatible high-speed internet. Professional installation required.
All right, it is Film Study with Ken McCusick again. Week 17, the final Ravens game, not only of 2017, but I guess this year's football season, as we're not going to get the playoffs this year. Ken McCusick, how are you doing now, a day after?
Just Trying to get over it still, Josh. How about you?
Yeah, it made it kind of ruined New Year's Eve. I'd say that, and it made it not something to be excited to hang out with other people for a New Year's Eve celebration. So, on the baseball season.
Yeah, we feel the same way about it. I mean, I think back to one particular game in Ravens history. It's the loss to the Colts after the Ravens went 13-3 during the regular season in 2006. And to go into that game and lose it at home was, first of all, a three-hour throttling of things getting worse and worse and worse progressively. Not like this game where it looked like the Ravens had it after a long comeback and then they blew it again. But it was very much a long throttling at the hands of the Colts that day. And I had a chance to meet with some people at work afterwards, and I could not bring myself to inflict myself upon them after that game. It just would have been horrible.
Yeah, and we've had tough losses as Raven fans, but I don't remember a game like this, this tough of a loss that was a regular season game that had everything on the line, that they were, 97% chance of playoffs before this, and everything went the wrong way. They came into the game soft, but you knew, all right, this is a second-half team, so you weren't too concerned. But, man, this was a tough loss for your offense to have the ball with 3 minutes or something on the game. Mm-hmm. And to not be able to stop the clock, and then the defense that you spent all this money and spent all of your offseason acquisitions, all your focus on the defense, it sucks to go a season and be swept by the Steelers and the Bengals.
Right, it's definitely a bummer. They didn't get swept by the Bengals; they shut them out in the first game. So I'll correct you that. But that's
all right,
okay.
Fine.
It does remind me of the Christmas game last year of being just the same kind of miserable finish to it. But boy, you wish something could have been different.
It was very frustrating, and I would not have. I know we'll talk about the future of the team and all. I would not have been surprised if Steve Bisciotti made an immediate decision last night with how that game was so just fell apart. Mm-hmm. It kind of represents the season all in one game.
Yeah, a lot of that, and we'll get to some individual player reasons for that and whatnot, but I agree there are some microcosms of the season running through this in a lot of different ways.
All right. Before we get all depressed and angry and tear apart this game and some individual things, I mean, the positive thing is we do have some young guys like Humphreys who did perform well, who is guys we can be hopeful for in the future.
Yeah, there are definitely, this is a good young defense. You know, all year long we've kind of talked about that in terms of everybody's really in their second or third year. It's not a defense that really has to get broken up. In terms of rebuilding it, they've only really got a couple players they need to be concerned of. They're probably going to let Brandon Carr go, and they need to make sure that that player is in position to take his place. They have a couple guys with pretty significant injuries going into the offseason that they need to make sure are really ready for camp. Hill comes to mind, and Smith in terms of what he can do for the team early in the season. But I do expect those guys to return by the middle of next year and be productive players. So I think the Ravens will have may devote some of their IR, DTR list next year to the defense. So Urban is the one guy they've got to think about replacing. He's a fourth-year guy. He'll be a free agent. And coming back from a pretty serious Liz Frank injury, so we'll have to see how that works out. Other than him, I think the team's in very good shape for next year.
Yes. Well, yes, on the defensive side.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yes. All right, let's get into the game and what went wrong yesterday.
Yeah, so I tried to think about how I wanted to write this up in the article, and I came up with five individual failures for the defense. This is, we're not even getting into the offense, ways in which it didn't work out yesterday against the Bengals. And I think you can at least go with the inability to stop the run on the first drive, the inability to convert any of several interception opportunities, and that's been a problem the last couple of games now for the Ravens, so we're going to spend a little bit of time on that. Costly penalties, particularly on the touchdown drives, There's an inability to convert the pressure opportunities for as much as they had. And a lot of Ravens fans will probably look at this game and say the Ravens didn't get any pressure at all. What are you talking about? I don't really believe that's true. I believe they actually had some success generating some pressure, and they certainly rushed numbers, but they didn't convert a lot of their pressure into meaningful results, and we'll talk a little bit about that. And then the final play itself is kind of a microcosm of the Ravens season, just a really bad situation, particularly in terms of how the safeties were set up on that play. So anyway, that's how we'll talk about it today.
Right, and let's start. There's no other place to start but the way the Ravens started the game. Let's start with that opening drive. You got a team coming in with not a whole lot to play for that you can really, if you can hit them hard early, you can really set the tone for the game, and it did not work out.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. The Bengals could easily have come out golf clubs over one shoulder and you know, in that kind of weather, given up on a game. I thought that a later game during the day actually benefited the Ravens in terms of the ability to get the Bengals to give up in this game. But they came out smoking, and as soon as they had that, you know, they'd gotten a taste of blood after that first drive. So
right.
they rushed five times on that drive, 11, 6, 6, 7, and 17 yards as the bulk of that 78-play drive. They also had a 17-yard penalty and I think about 14 yards in passing. So that got them down the field there. There's kind of a common thread that goes through this. Is that they had a lot of trouble getting their linebackers off blocks. Whether it was Mosley or Owosu, they were getting blocked effectively every play by a lineman. They ran some power plays. They also were just effective getting the linemen blocked as well. So, in particular, Williams did not make a contribution on that drive at all. He got double teamed pretty much the entire drive, held off by Bodine on one of the plays. So, you can go to the article, and I'd advise you to do that rather than me go through each one of these individually. Go through, kind of watch them one at a time. Help yourself go through the five stages on this Ravens season with your game pass. Two things about this. The 2017 Ravens fans are now the first team in franchise history to allow 4 yards per carry. They allowed 4.1. And even if you take out that Jacksonville fake punt, they'd still be over four. So anyway, that streak is over, as painful as that is. And it's a lot to me like the Orioles streak of having 18 straight winning seasons, you know, as far as a consistently dominating run defense that the Ravens had.
Right.
There's one other thing about it. The Bengals ran an unbelievable 52 offensive snaps in the first half. And that did include a spike and a kneel. But just to put that in perspective, that's 80% of the typical total for a game. In fact, the Ravens averaged 65.1 opponent snaps per game this year. So 52 is 80% of 65. So that's no way to build a mousetrap. And it obviously, with a lot of the repetition of snaps and whatnot, led to some tiring of players.
All right, Ken. So outside of that first drive, there was more things that went wrong. This team has heavily relied on the turnover, and they struggled with that on Sunday.
Well, that's right, Josh. I mean, that was obviously a huge problem on Sunday. And there were, as I counted them, six different plays where they could have had an interception and didn't pick one off. And there were probably a couple for the Bengals as well, but they converted one very big one and returned it 90 yards for a touchdown. So
I can't wait to talk about that when we do the offense.
Yeah, so we'll talk about that one at that time. But the Ravens missed a number of opportunities. A lot of them were related to pressure, that they had pressure in the backfield, or they got a hand on Dalton and he threw a floater, or they got a hand on the football and he threw a floater and they couldn't secure it. I've got all the times out there listed on the spreadsheet, but just to remind you of a few of them, we had a little pass over the middle to Bernard that he tipped, cold hands. We're talking about Mosley did not.
Yep.
Was not able to pull
in. He was close, not quite.
Yeah, didn't get it done. We had a couple plays where pressure, and they had a hand on Dalton, and he threw a floater. One to the sideline that Kennedy got a hand on. Another one that just fell among three Ravens over by that right sideline. So that was a shame both cases. And, of course, the big one, Weddle, had his interception that would have stopped the last drive. They had three on the last drive, by the way. But Weddle had the interception that would have stopped the last drive, and it was negated by Humphrey's defensive holding. So a bad set of missed opportunities there for this game, that's for sure.
Right, right. Yeah, I don't know which one stings more. I guess it's the Weddle one that really stings because we saw him catch it. We assumed the game was wrapped up, and it all comes back.
Yeah, well, there's that. And on that play, they almost had a sack from Za'Darius Smith. He spun Dalton 360 degrees in the pocket. First of all, it was a third and five play. So the worst, you'd hope, he gets sacked and it's third and close to 15. And that would have been good, you know, fourth and close to 15. Or, you know, the other possibility is that the interception occurs. But from looking at the replay, it looked as if Humphrey tackled LaFell so early in that play, and he really did just take him down, that it really was going to be called no matter what. Even if the sack had gone off, we would have just been disappointed by the holding call on the
back end. When you were watching the other camera angles and all, so was it a straight tackle? To me on the replay, it looked like maybe he fell and Humphrey fell over him.
I would love for that to be the case.
But it was a straight tackle?
There was contact beyond 10 yards. It looked pretty bad to me, too. And, you know, looking back at the season now as a whole and the way these two games have gone in particular, they missed four good opportunities against the Colts. They missed good opportunities, three of them against the Steelers. So going 0 for 13 in those three games, even though they did manage to win against the Colts, it kind of puts a black mark on a season where they had a remarkable, you know, they led the league in interceptions with 22, Jacksonville at 21, and they led the league in percentage of passes defensed converted into interceptions, which is 26.5%. And Jacksonville ended up being close to them at 25.9%. But you really have to, I'm not going to be able to think about those stats and really remember anything else but the failure in the two games in Pittsburgh and Cincinnati here yesterday as far as you know, what could have been for those statistics. So good year for interceptions for the Ravens, but it's always going to be tainted for me.
Right. And yeah. And for a team that shut out, what they get three shutouts this year and defense have played well. It seemed like whenever they really had a challenge, the defense couldn't step up and do it. And they had to rely on the offense, even to beat the Colts. It felt like the offense needed to win that game rather than the defense put it away.
You know, the offense did some good things in the Colts game, but I give the defense credit for keeping the Colts out of the end zone on those last two drives. And they did only allow 16 points. I think you got to really give that one more to the defense than to the offense in that game.
Okay.
But anyway, you're right. I mean, you know, it has felt at times like if you give the ball to the opponent with them having a chance to drive the field, you have a good chance to lose the game. And, you know, you should never really feel like that, particularly if you're pinning back the opponent fairly deeply like they did on this last Bengals drive yesterday.
Right, right. So I guess what do you think was the bigger issue? The not being able to get the ball with the interceptions or the stupid penalties like Humphreys that really cost them?
The penalties are all very costly. There's three of them. The Bengals only had five accepted penalties in the game. They had a couple others they declined. Pass interference on Boyle got declined, for example. I can't remember all the others, but they had five penalties for about 55 or 60 yards in the game, but three of them were just killers. On that first drive, they had a 17-yard DPI. First of all, it was on second and 10, I believe that occurred, and it set the Bengals up at the one-yard line. So it was a bad penalty that got them set up for a fairly easy score, and they actually got it through the air. But they had a good running drive, and they set themselves up with that pass interference on Green in the end zone.
Right.
And then there were two others. With 2 minutes left in the game, this is a penalty that's going to get overlooked because of Humphrey's defensive hold, but it did not look to me like Dalton was in any position to complete that pass to LaFell by the right sideline, but Carr interfered with him there, and that gave the Bengals a fresh set of downs again. And that was a darn shame. That got him out of jail on forget what the down and distance was there. It might have been second and 10 on that when that flag was thrown. So not a good penalty there. And of course the Humphrey tackle of LaFell, it could have negated a sack. It did negate an interception. But either way, it turned the game around. And it's just a shame. Humphrey had a good game. Otherwise, he really was part of the reason they shut down Green in this game. And, you know, we're going to remember some bad things about Humphrey here when he really had a great game and a great season.
Right. All right. We got to talk about the final play in that final drive. But let's first talk about the pass rush in general in this game.
Yeah.
And the pressure they were putting on Dalton.
Okay, so let's make sure we address this as better can. If I'm missing something, make sure you catch me from the notes here, Josh. So I think that the fans wanted a couple of things from Dean Pease in this game. They wanted him to take A.J. Green out of the game, and they did that. A.J. Green had two catches, 17 yards. He did get that DPI on Carr, but basically they shut him down, and they committed resources to doing that. And the other thing was, I think Ravens fans have been complaining all season about the amount of pressure that Pease has been willing to apply. Well, he really pulled out all the stops in terms of numbers in this game, and it really showed up very positively. The Ravens, if you look at how they did against numbers, they had six plays with six or more players rushing, and they only gave up 7 yards on those plays, so 1.2 yards per play. They had 11 plays where they rushed five, and they only gave up 4.3 yards per play on that. And they had 26 plays where they rushed four, and they only gave up 5.3 on that. All of those, they're winning numbers. 4.8 yards per pass. You should win a game. You only give up 4.8 yards per pass. But there was a hidden problem there. And that was, say it with me, at one sack and no turnovers in this game.
Yeah, and all right, the one sack by Judon, it was great. It seemed like they got in there a few times that they were going to get close, but didn't get it. You mentioned that it worked well when we were bringing six men in, and that was forcing Dalton, that was helping the team. Then what happened with this final play where suddenly we went into, I guess, some type of prevent style?
Yeah, I want to come back in a minute because there's a little bit more about the pass rush we should talk about here for first. So, you know, one of the we have the measure we talk about ample time and space to show how often a quarterback is really facing pressure or not facing pressure. And Dalton had ATS on just 15 of 44 dropbacks. That's 34%, and that's definitely a level at which you can expect to win a football game. And the Ravens really, in terms of yards per play, that really worked out that way, yards per pass attempt anyway. It really worked out that way, that they had a winning total. They just did not have enough variation plays. They didn't force enough holding calls on pass plays, and they did not have any turnovers to show for all their efforts, which we talked about already. And they only had one sack, and in fact, only had one quarterback hit to show for all their efforts on 44 dropbacks. So they had one other that was a spike. That doesn't count, but that's the basic problem here. Pease tried some things in terms of deception. They had four deceptive pass rushes, which is not a lot for one game, but it's not nothing either. They had 10 individual blitzes from off the line of scrimmage, so an attempt was made to add deceptive elements in that way. They had four stunts, and two of them led to big pressures, including the sack by Judon. They're beautiful stunts where Henry drew two or even three men to block him, and Judon had a very clean A-gap to rush through, so that was it was great in both cases. And then, you know, they had two guys drop from the line of scrimmage a lot because Pease has in recent weeks liked to show a six-man front and drop two guys out of that, which I think has been generally very effective. And it was not bad against Dalton in this game. They certainly rushed six out of it some, so it was a legitimate threat. It wasn't just, hey, we're going to show you six, and then you know we're going to drop two.
Right. So what you're setting up there is a decent game plan going into this.
Yeah, you know, I thought it really was, and I thought that Pease, you know, there's been a lot of vitriol about Pease after this game, but even before this game, about when he announced his retirement and people, you know, are so happy to be rid of him and all that. I mean, it's ridiculous. It really is. I mean, the Ravens' structural issues with this defense are still not infinitesimal. They have a bad second inside linebacker who's hurting the team. Mosley had an injury-filled season and had a lot of troubles. They lost their other guy who can rush from the inside, Brent Urban. And that's really hurt the team down the stretch in terms of the depth on the defensive line.
And you're not even getting yet to Tavon Young.
No.
And Zach Orr.
Yeah, the loss of Zach Orr. I mean, it did seem like they got a new cornerback whenever they needed one this year, which is nice. But they also had a lot of play out of Lardarius Webb, and Webb had a subpar year. So I think he's probably done with the Ravens. But they had a lot of structural weakness that they had to deal with on this defense. And I thought Pease did a very good job of it. He embraced the dime this year. It was out of necessity. I wish he'd done it earlier, but he embraced it this year and got terrific results out of Levine and now out of Clark in this final game and in the last few. It looked like Levine maybe got hurt in this game because he only played four snaps and wasn't playing special teams at the end. So kind of hobbled off at one point. I hope he doesn't have an Achilles or some injury that's going to linger into next season.
Right. And we'll talk about after Dean Pease where we go and all that. We'll get to that eventually. But you're right. People have a total short memory, as in Dean Pease announcing his retirement and everyone's glad to see him go and forgetting all that he's given to this team.
Yeah, I mean, this was his best year as a coordinator. I'm convinced of that. I liked him in 2014. He had a great pass rush team, and they did a great job of supporting the back end with the pass rush. But he did that with a lot of assets that were brought in, with Doomerville in particular, but also with McPhee still there, providing that incredible inside pass rush. Just that team had, in some ways, more to work with than what this team had. And I like what he did with this team. He certainly can't argue with the shutout results. He didn't lose a lot of leads this year, and that's hard to say after coming off the lost lead yesterday, but he didn't lose a lot of leads this year in general, and that was a positive situation. So anyway, the Ravens could quite possibly do worse than Dean Pease with their next defensive coordinator, so we'll see. Anyway, I think he's been a good DC, and the next one, I hope we'll bring something new to the table that improves this defense in a significant way. But you're right, Josh. We'll talk about that on another show.
Right. Plus, you were just happy this year because they used the dime, and you're a dime guy.
I am a dime guy, and the dime was tremendously effective this year. I mean, if you look at what they did with the dime this year, it was where most of the sacks and turnovers came, which is not too surprising because that's on third down. But they also were just much more successful playing dime, to the tune of under 5 yards per play with six defensive backs on the field.
Right. You ready to break down this final play?
Yeah, so we can do that, and we have to do it, and we didn't want it. So we had 59 minutes of frustration back and forth of the offense doing nothing in the first half, of the defense and offense playing very well together in the second half to get the Ravens back in the game with a number of successful drives and stops and whatnot. And, you know, despite the interception that was not Flacco's fault, it was really tipped around by Young in the air in a way where he was just kind of dribbling it almost for the defensive back to take it away from him and then go 90 yards the other way.
By Chris Moore.
Yeah, by
right,
Moore.
Right, Moore. Yeah, and it wasn't even a good defensive play as much as it was Chris Moore not holding on to the ball.
That's right.
Not pulling it in.
Yeah, or even knocking it down, either one of those. But the Ravens had their way offensively with the Bengals in the second half. The Bengals only ran 5 plays offensively in the third quarter after they ran 52 in the first half.
That's great.
So that's pretty amazing.
Well, yeah, and that's where it got exciting, and we came back, and we took the lead over. And
yeah, you know what? That's something I may forget to mention this on the offensive show, but let me just say this. As a fan, and when I'm at the game, when the Ravens are on defense, my immediate thought is, what personnel do they have on the field? How are they defending this guy? Who's going to get double covered? What's going on? I'm very much analytically in the moment when we watch football on defense. And that's true to a lesser extent on offense. I love to watch the offensive line play. I like to watch where the blitz is coming from. But there was a time during that second half where I was just thrilled to see what's the next offensive play going to be. It's like opening a Christmas present almost. And Marty Morningweg, he's had some variation in play calling that I've really enjoyed. And a lot of what the Ravens did was kind of deceptive, even in terms of the formation yesterday. And I just found myself, you know, 12 years old again, watching the football game and enjoying it from that perspective and liking it a lot in that second half when they were so effective throwing the ball 10 yards or running the ball for 7 or 10 yards. And getting things done. That 4th-and-3 play where they reversed the field took me back to a similar play from Curtis Dickey many years ago. So it was exciting to watch that second half of offensive football.
Plus, you've got to always play the fun game of who are we putting on the field?
Yeah.
As we went down to 2 wide receivers to end the game with.
Yeah, boy, was that difficult. So I guess they had Woodhead, and they could put him as a receiver, and they had some tight ends that they could use in that formation, although they need him to block.
But, right.
They did not have a lot of offensive linemen, a lot of offensive skill position players left at the end of that game.
Right. So, but back on the defense, we've got a whole episode. We'll get to break down the offense and talk about how Joe finished out the game because that is its own issue. But let's talk about the defense. The Bengals get the ball back. They got this 4th-and-12 play with 53 seconds left in the game.
Right. So they're at the 49-yard line. It's too far for a field goal. It would have been a 66-yard opportunity. They have a kicker they like, but that would have not worked out. So a couple of things bothered me even before the snap here. And the first was Jefferson dropped to be the single high safety. Now, we've talked a little bit about not trying to use Jefferson on the back end all right. the year. We'll get back to this a little bit later. But him dropping a single high, I'm thinking, what the hell is going on? Weddle was about 3 yards behind the line of scrimmage. So to set the scene here, the Ravens lined up 6 across to show the double-A gap blitz look. Okay, so double-A is a general term I use to say that they're showing 6 across. And it's often used to say that your inside linebackers crawl up and are crowding each side of the A-gap, but it's used more broadly now to just any 6 across look at the line of scrimmage is you're showing the double-A blitz.
Okay.
So anyway, they had Clark and Mosley right up at the line of scrimmage, and they had behind that 3 yards, they had Weddle roaming around. Now, Weddle did tap somebody on the butt and said something. It was Clark. And I understand the need to communicate with that player, but Weddle is the team's best back end player, and he's got to be back guarding the sticks in that situation. And so he started to skip backwards before the ball was snapped and was approximately 9 or 10 yards back off the line of scrimmage as the ball was snapped. That's not deep enough.
Especially if you're going into this prevent plan that you just got to keep the ball out of the end zone.
Well, you got to keep the ball. You got to basically defend the sticks. That was one play for the game right there. They need to defend the sticks. But 10 yards is not deep enough still. They're not going to be able to defend the sticks from that. And there was no one to play safety on the side of the field where there were two receivers. So that's where Boyd and LaFell were. Green was on the other side. And they moved Jefferson over, and Humphrey and Jefferson doubled Green. Great use of resources. I completely concur with that usage. However, not getting Weddle back into position screwed up Kennedy on the play because Kennedy felt like he had to be the deepest player and stay behind Boyd on that play. And that meant he was soft about 4 yards behind him. And not only did he allow the reception, but then Boyd ran by him for the touchdown after the catch. So the problem was really where Weddle was positioned on that. They dropped Clark and Mosley from the line of scrimmage. No problem. You want to play that game. They had two eligible receivers that were starting originally in the backfield, and then they were just lined up as a tight end. And I don't know even what to call him because he's like a yard behind the lineman. That was where Bernard was. So Mosley and Clark were in a position to cover both Bernard and the tight end Croft coming out of the backfield. So no problem. They weren't improperly positioned. It all comes down to Weddle. And why the hell wasn't he on the back end? So I don't know whether that was an individual decision by him or whether he was instructed to move up there and then drop back as part of the scheme for the play. I really don't know. But he was out of position, in my opinion. I cannot come up with any logical reason why it makes sense.
Right. That was my question for you. If there was some type of deception going on and Weddle was just too slow to get back in position or what was going on?
Well, it's pretty poor deception because whatever you give away a couple of seconds before the snap, whether or not they can change a play on it, and they probably couldn't, the quarterback can still take that into account and figure out, we got man coverage on this guy, or oh, he's defending this zone, you know, whatever it might be. So you're giving it away if you show that far ahead of the snap.
Okay.
So anyway, it was something I cannot come up with any reason. And when I think about this season, look back to when the Ravens were 4-5. One of our big complaints about it, and I think for all Ravens fans, was that Jefferson was not playing well on the back end and was blowing a lot of coverages there.
Yeah, they were throwing the ball over us.
They were throwing the ball over us and really taking advantage of Jefferson in a lot of the games we lost early in the season, particularly Jacksonville and Pittsburgh. I remember him being out of position a couple of times. But anyway, the other problem was that Weddle was being out-muscled near the line of scrimmage. Remember the 58-yard overtime run by Howard? In the Pittsburgh game, there's some video of Weddle just getting creamed near the line of scrimmage by either linemen in some cases, but in one case by a wide receiver. I think it's Juju, but you can't even see it because he flashes through the screen so quickly, wipes Weddle out. So that wasn't the place for him. Weddle was needed on the back end, and Pease did a very good job the rest of the season making sure that those roles were more defined, that he had Weddle up close to the line of scrimmage less often, and that he had more of Weddle's specialty being his and Jefferson's specialty being helping with run defense and making use of him. And just to have this fall apart on the last play of the season and not having the guys where they need to be, I don't know who's responsible, but I'm upset by the play.
Yeah, and it's not the way for it's a horrible play call to end your season on, to end Dean Pease's career on.
That's right.
It was just a very disappointing way, and even hard for us Raven fans to process as we saw it happen.
Right, and I, a lot of people won't get technically into how he was so far out of position on that play. I mean, they won't. I did see one tweet about it that the guy was right on the money, and you know, he said, you know, it was something like, don't we have to be as deep as the deepest or as wide as the widest? I think that was Billick's right. old way of saying the thing. And he's right on the money. I mean, you know, Weddle was just, he was the problem on that play, and it messed up everything on the back end. Kennedy then had to adjust, and it's upsetting. I don't think my guess is that it was an individual decision by Weddle on that play, and I wouldn't be surprised if we hear at some point this offseason what happened on that particular play and what went wrong.
Right, because it's not something that the game reporters were going to ask after the game. Hey, Weddle, what were you doing?
Yeah, it's not even something to necessarily catch in real time. So it is what it is.
All right, let's look at, I guess that's kind of an individual look at Weddle. Let's look at some other guys. Brandon Williams, when he came back from injury, he made a big impact on the team in stopping the run game. The past couple weeks, that hasn't worked, and it didn't work again yesterday. What's going on with Brandon Williams?
Yeah, particularly on that first drive, he had just a really bad drive where he was getting pushed around by double teams. There's something called a combination block, which I want to explain because we use this terminology on the show fairly regularly, but I want to explain what it is. But a combination block basically has two linemen, usually the center and a guard, or most commonly the center and a guard, will each block the same player, and it's usually one of the large interior players since it's a center and a guard doing the blocking. So a center and a guard block Brandon Williams, and then one guy has him pinned, okay, for the other, and oftentimes that means he's a little bit off balance, or he's on one foot, or he's got a back pedal going, and then the other player, the guard or the center, whichever one is the appropriate one, can then continue that block and maintain it while the other one peels off and combinations to a player in level two, most often a linebacker. And there was just too much of that on that first drive. Williams has to do a better job of holding the point of attack, even against a double team, and trying to maintain his space on the field. He and Pierce are both good at it in general, but in this game, Brandon Williams was playing hurt. I don't know if that had anything to do with it. He's got some sort of a back injury he came into the game with and missed some practice time for last week, or was limited, I should say, in practice for last week. So I'm not sure exactly what might have been wrong on those plays, but the Bengals certainly took over the momentum right on that first drive with a very good set of run plays.
It seemed like it wasn't that long ago that we were talking about Peanut and him fighting to get some playing time. He got some playing time. How do he do, and what does it mean for the future of Peanut with the Ravens?
Well, I think that he's been more effective than Correa in terms of throwing his body around and trying to do things in level two. He's probably more undersized for the position. You know, those are not the only two options, obviously. And I think that what the Ravens really need to do is pick up an inside linebacker as a draft pick. Maybe Owosso and he share the time next year, or maybe the new guy is the guy right away. But they need to invest in a draft pick at some level to shore up the inside linebacker situation. At the very least, they've got to make some sort of acquisition so that if Mosley is lost for any period of time, they have a reasonable player to substitute with. So I would not mind an extra two-down thumper, certainly as the second linebacker. I don't think that would be a bad idea. They've got the dime that they want, I think, in Levine, or perhaps it's Clark next year who will be the primary dime. So I think they've got ways to get back the linebacker by the linebacking situation otherwise. But Owosso had a bad game in this one. He got pushed around a lot, and it hurt.
Yeah. How about Brandon Carr? What did you think of his play yesterday?
You know, it was mixed. He definitely had some good plays on the football. I wish he had gotten the pick six. Where the ball was thrown to Green and he stepped right in front of him. It was a great instinct play, just did not convert the hands play into the pick six as it could have been done. But it was nice. He prevented a touchdown probably by making that play. Certainly once he decided to gamble, he prevented a touchdown by making the play. He did some other things that were good in terms of getting a couple other PDs, but he also had a couple of very key penalties. So I think that he's going to be a cornerback who has limitations. Didn't do poorly for the Ravens this year. I mean, four picks and his general level of production, you can't expect a lot more than that at a corner. So I'm not too concerned about his level of play in general and that he let the team down. But I think the Ravens need to try and go probably with younger boundary corners, which means that they're going to want to give Kennedy time on the outside, and they're going to want to stay with Humphrey. Jimmy Smith is with the team next year no matter what. He's got a $13 million cap hit, I think 13 and a half.
As long as he doesn't take performance enhancing.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, I'm glad to get that suspension out of the way this year,
yes.
But yeah, it's a big deal. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, it's tough to ask you about any player without starting to look to the future. And I glanced for some mailbag questions, and all the mailbag questions are about the future. We're done with this game. Everyone wants to talk about the future, which is a great way that we can talk about the future of the film study podcast and what we've got coming up, because we've got one more show this week about the offense, and then there's no more games to talk about as far as the Ravens. So you want to share what we're doing this offseason?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that this is a great opportunity, Josh. So we're going to talk about some player analysis review and exactly how we're going to structure that. And we haven't decided exactly what, but in the past I've usually written one article about the offensive line in aggregate and talk about each individual play and what they did well and how they need to improve and this and that. So I think there'll be one of those this year and perhaps one for each position group. And whether we break that up into one show or two shows or four shows, well, Josh and I'll have to figure out about what's the way to do it. One thing I do want to do is do another high-level roster evaluation. So we've had these things we've done during the season where we look up on the bye week, for example, at how these players rank among those five categories that we have, you know, a young star who's still right. In his first contract, et cetera, et cetera.
But the offseason's also where we need to get the money involved and what these guys are making.
Yeah, there you go. So I'm hoping we can get Brian McFarlane on the show for that. Excellent cap guru from Russell Street Report, and definitely somebody we want to include in that kind of a discussion. Brian, everybody, you know, people sometimes will put down what a person doesn't know, but Brian McFarlane knows a lot about football in addition to knowing a lot about the cap, and we know a little bit about football to go. I'm sorry, a little bit about the cap to go along with a lot about football.
Right.
And so, you know, it'll be very good to get Brian on the show. He's a great guy to talk football with. I think we'll want to talk about new acquisitions as they come in. So if the Ravens have a significant one, we'll probably do a mini pod on that.
Like at least a new defensive coach.
I think we can do one for that.
We're gonna be acquiring a new defensive coach.
There you go. So there definitely will have to be a decision made. Let's just talk about that briefly about the defensive coordinator.
Okay, Peter's
retiring. So I mean, the one I put out, I asked for knee-jerk reactions on Russell Street about that, and I can't put out knee-jerk reactions on Pease, and it doesn't even matter to put out knee-jerk reactions on Pease's performance beyond what I've already said on this episode. So there's not anything more. I think he had his best year. I think that, you know, anything more than that is just, you know, you're nitpicking about it. He's gone anyway, so why bother? But he didn't let a lot of leads get away this year, so.
All right.
My view is all towards how do they address this in terms of hiring.
All right, then my question for you is, when you draft all these defensive guys and they don't come in and make huge impacts, when you think of a guy like Bowser, who was their number one draft pick, who did not get much playing time this year, who do you blame? Do we look at Dean Pease and say he didn't get this guy ready, or do we look at Ozzie Newsome and he doesn't have what it takes anymore to draft high-level players?
Well, you at least have three groups that you could consider. You got those two. So Ozzie might have drafted the wrong guy.
Right.
I don't think that's the case in Bowser. I think Bowser has a lot of promise. Bowser is just in a very crowded position group to get snaps with Judon and Suggs and Za'Darius Smith all wanting snaps at outside linebacker. You know, it's hard to find spot for Bowser. He only played one snap in this last game.
Right.
And then the other thing I'd say is that you really got to consider what's the position coach's responsibility and development here. You know, we give a lot of credit to Dallas Sandres and his ability to work with the offensive line and make more out of less there. But he's a position group coach. And whether there's an outside linebackers coach who should be doing more, that's Martindale, I guess, is the outside linebacker coach. You know, you got to really look at who's the guy who should be doing that. But anyway, there's multiple levels. In Bowser's specific case, I think it's a case of it's a crowded position and a very talented position on the Ravens. But I want to get back to this hire for just a minute, because Bisciotti did a great thing in 2008 when they hired Harbaugh. He gave the PSL owners a, I think it might have been as much as 8 pages devoted in one of these off-season magazines to how did they do the hiring process for John Harbaugh.
Right.
It's one of the best things they ever did. And it went through all of these things about how they broke down the initial candidates, made their list, how they do the interviews. You know, one guy was responsible for picking up the guy at the airport, and he would start the interview process in the car. And then they would, you know, they would go through and they would do additional interviews, right. And then they made decisions and had meetings and did that. And they had it down to Jason Garrett and John Harbaugh. Well, that process obviously is very successful at identifying great candidates.
Yeah, and I know Steve Bisciotti. I've had many conversations with him. That process doesn't surprise me. That's the type of guy he is. The problem is when you're hiring a defensive coach and offensive coordinators, you are trusting the head coach to make those hires.
And that's where I don't think you can agree with that. I think this has to be an organizational decision, and I want Bisciotti's stamp on this hiring process. Normally, you might say this is too low in the organization to make that judgment. No, it's not. It really is not. And what you really need to make sure is that in any organization, that your top people, you don't ever put them in a position where they might even fall victim to nepotism would be one possibility, just favoritism within the organization or not considering all the alternatives on a level playing field. Bisciotti needs to create the blueprint from his own background for how this gets done. But I'd say I want all of the following. I want Harbaugh not to have a sole vote or even veto power on this hire. I want this to be an organizational decision where, you know, it's a maybe an even vote kind of person. But the only person I want to truly have the veto power on this would be Bisciotti himself.
And I agree. And I think that's how John Harbaugh keeps his job. If he doesn't want to, if they don't want to knock him out this offseason and say, hey, your coordinators didn't work out, then the way you do it is you get rid of the coordinators and you say, I'm helping you get the coordinators.
Right. Yeah, it is. I can understand how Harbaugh would be unhappy about losing authority in that situation. I've already heard stories about Harbaugh and his lost authority with individual players in terms of going to Newsom about it. And that it's, we actually heard this in a State of the Ravens thing. So Kevin Byrne is the one who told the story. But he recounted with both Harbaugh and Newsom there that he would often hear Harbaugh as a rookie coach in 2008. It was after the 2008 right. season. Would go into Newsom's office and complain about some particular player. And Newsom would sit there calmly and listen to him and then respond, well, you know, we paid this guy, you know, $14 million
more than you.
3 years. We can't get rid of him.
Right.
You know, so, and no, then he would.
Yeah, and we heard that with Harbaugh and especially veterans with Ed Reed and Pollard, guys that clashed heads with Harbaugh.
Sure.
So, yeah, we know he's got an ego.
Right. And ego, you know, a desire to run things. I'm okay with that. I mean, you should want to run things if you're the boss.
Yeah, but successful head coaches have egos. Sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think successful players have egos too, and I'm fine with that. But I just go through the other things I want from this hiring process because there's a list here. But right. It's fine to have one internal candidate. It's fine to have more than one internal candidate. But you have to have several external candidates. And I would put that as a minimum on this. This is the marquee coordinator position in the entire NFL. There is none better. Maybe to be offensive coordinator for the Patriots is a better place to be, but to be defensive coordinator for the Baltimore Ravens with the way they invest and they draft for the defense with the young talent they currently have in place, there is no better spot in the entire NFL to land as a coordinator than that spot. And I can't imagine any other group. You basically, normally, when you're a coordinator, you come in and a guy has just messed things up and you're getting the keys to a Yugo. You're literally getting the keys to a Ferrari if you get the Ravens defense. It may have a couple of engine things that need to be worked on, but it's a Ferrari. And it's an organization that treats the defense very well. So there's no reason why every single coordinator out there who's very good or every single position coach, whether it's in the NFL or at the college level, couldn't be considered for this role, and you take the very best one available. And if that's in the organization, fantastic. If it's not, fantastic also. But just make sure you avail yourself of all potential options.
Right.
One more thing I'm going to say is okay. There's going to be a lot of talk about former head coaches who've had success, and many of them in the Ravens organization.
Right. Marvin Lewis, back. Chuck Pagano.
Yeah, there you go. Jack Del Rio.
Sure.
Nolan and Rex Ryan, we didn't even mention, I don't think. So, I mean,
yeah, they're all out there.
There's are five guys right now who are available, and I think any of them could probably still coach football and be good coaching the defense. There is no reason not to get one of them, and some of them would add a stability value potentially because a lot of them will not return to head coaching. Like, I don't think Rex Ryan is going to get another head coaching opportunity. Yeah, That's just my opinion.
But there's no way Rex Ryan and John Harbaugh are getting along.
I hear that, but I think it's a matter of they did get along for 1 year. The Ravens had a great year, went to the AFC Championship. Let's say they hated each other. Is that terrible?
Right. So you're saying, yeah, if you need each other, you find ways to get along.
Yeah, you find ways to get along. And it's just it needs to be very clearly spelled out for Ryan that he's not getting a head coaching opportunity here. And, you know, we want to hire a guy for some stability. Ryan, you know, they're going to pay him well, so it might be that he would leave and go get a DC gig somewhere else. But more likely, you know, whoever you hire among old coaches that are not going to get another head coaching job are guys who you could get some stability value out of. You can get them for 4 or 5 years. Now, I'm not going to. I don't want them, the Ravens, to put a zero value on that, but I also don't want them to put a very high value on that because that's how you get away from ever getting that revolutionary young coordinator who gets you started in the direction. Yeah, maybe he goes and he's a coach somewhere else at the head coaching level from 2 years from now, but he gets your organization rebuilt, gets the defensive structure re put in place, gets a new defense put in, and the new guy that is his heir apparent within the organization, you have a succession plan, he takes over and the defense is largely the same. I would love for the Ravens to hire a great coach for 2 years who then lose to a head coaching opportunity.
Right. And the problem with those stability guys who aren't going to get head coaching anymore is that TV money is really nice too. And those guys are also now being wooed not only by other football teams but by sports networks.
Yeah, and Gruden's coming out of the broadcast booth to go back to the Raiders apparently.
Yeah, that's the rumor.
We've got that. So, you know, I don't think any of these other guys have such a lucrative opportunity. Lewis is the only guy I've really heard about going into the front office and doing something.
Right.
It doesn't seem like that'd be too much of a stretch for Nolan either. But for Ryan and for Pagano and maybe for Del Rio, I really have never heard that attached to their name.
Those are field guys.
Yeah, field guys.
All right. Well, we went deep into that, and I'm really excited for when we get to have that show to say, "Hey, here's the guy that the Ravens brought in. Here's what we think. Here's what it looks like that the process was to get the guy." And that'll be fun. Another show that we're going to have to do this offseason is the draft. Before or after the draft, we're going to have to cover this and see what the Ravens do if they continue to focus only on defense on the draft. Or if they go and try again with a wide receiver.
I do think that they're gonna spend most of their picks on offense in this coming year.
They need
a tight end. Yes, and I think if I had to really look at it defensively, it really looks like they only need two picks, an inside linebacker and a safety that are absolutely required. Now, that doesn't mean you don't continue to regenerate and get a sixth-round corner or a seventh-round corner that you think is a developmental guy that has value. It doesn't mean you don't do that, but I think the required picks are a safety and inside linebacker. And although it's probably a heresy to think so about what they use the first-round pick on, safety is a position where if you don't spend a first-round pick on it, you probably will not get the kind of playmaker they want for the back end. And the Ravens suffered a lot having only one real back-end playmaker this year. And it took them time to finally get that set up, but to only have one for the year did hurt the team. So that's something.
All right. And then also this offseason we will have at least one show, if not multiple, leading into camp and during camp and how that's going.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. So we'll look at the roster, see who they've assembled. If we don't have a particular show on some players, we can talk about some of the acquisitions that didn't quite meet the standard of having their own show to still talk about how do they fit into this defense or offense. And I think that'll be a lot of fun. And Josh, I look forward to this. Had a great year doing this with you this year, and maybe we should save this for after the mailbag. But it's been constantly fun, and what Josh does to put this show together, you guys cannot even imagine in terms of technically how he has to set this up and do the recordings and then get them out on Audio Boom and on Russell Street Report and other places. So it's a big job, and I appreciate what you do for the show.
Thank you. And yeah, and the whole reason we're laying out this offseason is to make sure you don't unsubscribe. Stay subscribed. You'll get new shows periodically. I mean, you're going to get a new one in 2-3 days when we talk about the offense, and then more next week. So make sure, even though the Ravens fell apart, don't take out that anger on the Ravens by deleting the film study podcast. We're still there for you. We'll be there for you next year. Mailbag is we're not going to get to the mailbag today because there's so much stuff in there that's got to be sorted out. There's one question, though, about yesterday that I just want to bring up. Mm-hmm. James Harrison got more sacks than the Ravens yesterday. Were you surprised by that?
Did James Harrison have 2 sacks
yesterday? He got 2 sacks playing against the Jets yesterday.
That's terrible. No, I did not hear.
Yeah.
Obviously, we get wrapped up in the game, and then we come home, and whatever. I've got no excuse for not knowing that James Harrison had 2 sacks yesterday, but it was what it was.
Yeah.
Wow.
So just wanted to point that out to you before we get out of here. Is your defensive evaluation up on Russell Street right now?
It is. It's up there, so you can read it, go to Game Pass, work through that. Follow me on Twitter, at Film Study Ravens. We always, every show, we want to make sure you give Josh's, our sister show, a check as well. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Ravens season is over. Make sure you listen into Section 336 as well as we go on, which is weekly, nonstop, year-round. And now it's, I guess it's going to be baseball season for Section 336. And we'll see if the Orioles do something. We'll see what happens first. The Ravens sign a defensive coordinator or the Orioles sign a pitcher. So that's Section 336. You can go and check that out.
Why would they need it? They've got a good, perfectly good four-man rotation already if you take the top two pitchers in AAA, right?
Yeah, and the Ravens don't need wide receivers.
Yeah, okay.
So, all right, Ken, have a good night. We will talk in a few days to break down the offense.
All right, and we apologize for not getting all the mailbag questions this time. We make sure we will promise that we'll get to all of them on the next show.
Yeah, mailbags just flooded, so I don't even know how to start reading through between comments and questions and sorting it out.
We can have a special show on the mailbag if it's required, Josh. We will get to every one of these mailbag questions.
All right. Have a good night.
Take it easy.
Bye.
Introducing the Lowe's List for Innovation. While our aisles are filled with innovative products, we've selected our favorites just for you. Like the exclusive Whirlpool washer with industry-first 2-in-1 removable agitator. We love this washer because you can customize any load. And with other smart features to streamline your laundry routine, this product is a must-have for families. Shop the full Lowe's List of top picks at Lowe's.com. Lowe's, home to any budget, home to any possibility. U.S. only.
Some cars are comfy on the inside, but don't have power on the outside. And some cars have the horsepower, but none of the comfort. I used to think there weren't any cars that were the total package. But that all changed when I got my Honda SUV. It's rugged and sophisticated. And right now, Honda has deals on the entire Honda SUV lineup. CR-V, HR-V, Pilot, Passport, you name it. So if you're looking for a car that's the total package, the only place you'll find it is at your local Honda dealer. Hurry before they're all gone.